So tonight, this is such an auspicious night. So I have to share this. I just think when things line up together, maybe it's the Virgo in me. When things line up, it's like, this is auspicious. So it's the first day of the month. So May 1st, we're starting our talk. Onto the Path with Right View starts tonight. It's the first day in the month of May, so we're going to start kind of celebrating Vesak, which comes towards the end of the month. I'll talk about that during the announcements, but it starts out. I mean, some people started it on Sunday, but we're starting out. It just feels like it's auspicious because we're starting out all in alignment. So it just seems auspicious that you're here. Came here, even though May Day parade, May Day protest, whichever one you want to call it, still came. Game tonight, still came. See? It's very auspicious that you're here. It's not random. So we're started on Right View, and in some respects, Right View is kind of like the beginning of the practice and the end of the practice simultaneously. Simultaneous. It starts us out. It starts us out onto this Eightfold Path, this noble path that we're on. And it starts at the beginning, so sometimes it's called right understanding, right view, right understanding. And this right view, right understanding is what is the first factor that you talk about. So the remember we talked about at the beginning that these factors in the Eightfold Path are cultivated in order, which is a little different than most practices. You just can cultivate any one of the faculties or any one of the factors, elements of all these different lists in the practice. But in the Eightfold Path, you're supposed to practice them in order. And so we start with right view. But at the same time, view, having right view, is where our wisdom lies, and it's the ultimate goal. It's the end game of having this much greater wisdom in our capacity to deal with whatever comes up and to see through some of the delusion that shows up in the way we live and the way we act. Buddha, a quote here from Buddha said that he sees no single factor so responsible for the arising of unwholesome states of mind as wrong view, and no factor so helpful for the arising of wholesome states of mind as right view. He said that there's no single factor so responsible for the suffering of living beings as wrong view, and no factor so poignant Poignant. Okay. That is not a black word. Poignant. So no factor so poignant in promoting the good of living beings as right view. It's just that. Wrong view, right view, whole basic structure starts out on this path in that way. So if you're thinking about at the beginning, why is it that this idea that right view and wrong view could be so delineated, meaning that if you have wrong view, you are going down a path of suffering. You are going to have miserable time. You have right view, you're going down a path of liberation. You're going to have happiness time, goodwill, good energy. But at the same time, everybody in this room knows that life can still get pretty crappy. Seems like it shouldn't just be about the view, or there should be something else going on here. So hopefully over the course of the night, I can kind of, what I would think of as tease apart how come view is far more important than the conditions that show up in our lives, whatever those conditions may be, good stuff, bad stuff. The view is far more important. So we'll just start back, take a step back here and think about it from this perspective. This is like the generally. Our view, whatever that view is the backdrop to everything in our lives, everything. I mean, it is the framework of everything that we have, everything we do. So all of our movements, all of our actions, all of our conduct is based on some view that we have on the world. Any kind of attitude you wake up in the morning, carry around with you all day, your mood, the choices you make in your life, these are all coming, arising out of whatever the view is that you're holding in any given time. Even more succinctly, our opinions, our judgments, our assumptions that we make in life is based on our view. It's not based on truth. It's not based on right. Our assumptions, judgments, opinions are based on our view. Our sense of self, who we think we are, our sense of who we think the world is, who we think other people are, our perceptions, how we hear things, how we see things, how we smell things, how we feel things, our choices, all the decisions we've made. Just imagine all the decisions you've made over your entire life. It stems out of view. And then to make it even more kind of convoluted here, perceptions, choices, assumptions, opinions, our actions, movements, all these things I just named, attitudes, moods, they're all conditional. They're all arising out of some conditions that come together. Either they're conditioned because of some past experience, some past conditioning, habits that push us forward, or some conditions have come together in this moment in time, and that's creating the view. Or we're taking some, you know, we're using our view, projecting it into the future about what we think is going to happen. So it's all this conditional aspect of the world that we live in the backdrop of this view. So my take on that is that if you see that conditioning, you see and understand and remember that that conditioning is all around us, that's right view. You don't see it, and you somehow or another forget that everything in our life is built up on top of conditioning, that's wrong view. You will be projecting out into the world as if whatever your view is correct. Ajahn Chah said that whenever we feel that we are definitely right, so much so that we refuse to open up to anything or anybody else, right there, we are wrong. It becomes wrong view, When suffering arises, where does it arise from? The cause is wrong view. The fruit of that wrong view being suffering. If it was right view, it wouldn't cause suffering. So there's a thought. If it were right view, it wouldn't cause suffering. When I read that quote today, I immediately begin to think about, wait a minute, I'm like suffering over some of the politics that are going on, and I think I got the right view. I know some of you in this room think you got the right view. So how is it that I can be suffering when I believe I have the right view? I think that's where the practice, Dhamma practice, begins to move us in a different direction. And I'm hoping I can say this with you know, don't just create a whole bunch of confusion in the whole thing, because what I have to talk about is kind of convoluted. So in order to begin to see how, even if I think I'm right in my political stance or my social justice stance, if I'm suffering from it, if I'm suffering in the midst of it, I'm stuck in a wrong view, and I'm suffering from that view that's behind it, these assumptions and all of this energetic force that comes from behind it. So let's see if I can split this in such a way that it, you know, you don't leave here saying, I don't know what Tori's talking about, but she is flat out wrong. You know, we don't, what did Ajahn Chah say? We know we're definitely right. So much so, we refuse to open up to anything or anybody else. So, you step back and you can think of view as being having two aspects to it. First, mundane view. Second, super or superior mundane view. We're just going to look at the mundane view. And it relates to how we relate to our relative reality. So how we're going about holding our daily tasks. And according to Bhikkhu Bodhi, he said that in order to understand mundane view, you have to have a correct understanding of this thing that I'm basically too afraid to talk about. So I thought I would go from the back and talk about the Pali word first. So there's a word in Dhamma that's called, that stands for a volitional act. That's it. Just two words, volitional act. Doesn't have a lot of weight around it. It's just an act, right? Some action. But the Pali word for that volitional act is kama. And when you say the word kama in English, all of a sudden it just gets all heavy and negative, and people have all this judgment around what kama is. It's a volitional act. What Bhikkhu Bodhi said, the literal name that is shortened to kama is right view of the ownership of action. So it's the right view on who owns action. Or another way you could think of it a little bit broader is all beings are the owners of their actions. They're the heirs of their actions. They spring from their actions, are bound up by their actions and supported by their actions. So whatever action, deeds we do, good or bad, we're the heirs of those actions. I think that is just basic stuff our moms and dads told us when we were little kids. There are consequences to actions, and you're responsible for those consequences. But if you look up the word karma in the dictionary, it says, it is the force created by a person's actions that is believed to determine what that person's next life will be. That's pretty heavy. Or it says, it's the force created by a person's actions that some people believe causes good or bad things to happen to that person. You can see why we get caught in this inevitable difficulty around karma. And it ties into view. When our view is closed, our actions are closed as well. We're stuck in a cycle. But before I get there, I jumped ahead. So I looked up the words action and volition, thinking, okay, maybe if I look up the words action and volition, that it would make a little bit more sense. So the word action, it just means an act of will, a thing that's done, a deed. Pretty simple. Volition, it just means the power to make your own choices and decisions. So we have this power to act. We have this choice. We make these choices and we act all the time. How this ties in, this awareness, this kind of recognition that we act all the time and we are doing things all the time. So all of our behaviors, our thoughts, an action is considered a thought, it's a deed, it's a spoken. So everything we say, everything we do in movement, everything we think is setting in motion consequences. It's setting in motion future conduct, future conditions. And it is continuous, it is constant, this setting in motion of condition, 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 condition. I like this quote by Pema Chodron. She said, people get into a heavy-duty sin and guilt trip, feeling that if things are going wrong, that means they did something bad or they're being punished. That's not the idea at all. The idea of karma is that you continuously get the teachings you need to open your heart. To the degree that you don't understand in the past, how to stop protecting your soft spot. Oh, excuse me. To the degree that you didn't understand in the past how to stop protecting your soft spot, how to stop armoring your heart, you're given this gift of teaching in the form of your life to give you everything you need to open up further. I like that definition. I like this definition because if karma is, if under this mundane view, beginning to understand the nature of karma, then you're beginning to understand that there, that everything that happens in our world is conditional and it does not stop. This idea that somehow or another, let me just back up a minute to see just how broadly defined this would be. They say that some karma doesn't ripen right away. It could ripen any time. So that means, basically, I could have done stuff when I was 16. Well, I should say I probably did do stuff when I was 16 that's kind of ripening now. So if I turn around and look at my life and say, oh, something bad is happening to me now. What did I do? How do I fix this? It doesn't make any sense. It just means if I think about it from the way Pema Chodron talks about it, whatever is coming your way is giving you the opportunity you had before to open the heart, and you didn't. And now you can. So now you can begin to open up to places where you weren't so open before. But doesn't that sound like what practice is like? Doesn't it sound like that the longer we practice, the more we're able to open up to things we couldn't open up to before? And now we have this capacity to be with, accept, listen to, understand things that before we would have just been rigid. It's just this and nothing more. So if you take that understanding of karma, it's kind of rudimentary because I'm not an expert on karma, but if you take just that basic drop, this idea from Pema Chodron, that everything about karma is really about helping us open up from places we were closed before, then right view is this ability to be right here, right now, with whatever is arising. Because when we ignore the right here, right now, you can see we're going to start operating out of old energy. Old energy that was closed stays closed. Old places where we had opinions and judgments about people stays right there because we're not really paying attention and our life is just flowing on. And we're stuck in these conditional habits all the time, over and over and over and over, constantly trying to change that and somehow or another come into this better life. It doesn't happen because we keep repeating the same conditional patterns of closed, closed, closed. But if you begin to practice this idea that the view, that somehow or another, this right view, somehow or another, my view is pushing up against everything in my world. It's pushing up against all my conducts, my thinking. I mean, when I think about coming from a trauma world, when I think about some of the stuff I said to myself, it's no wonder I was always walking around with a halo or a cloud of rain around me all the time, because everything about the way I saw life and saw me was so wrapped in this conditioning of trauma that everything was like negative, not gonna work, can't really do it, I don't believe it, I don't know. That's the way I walked around. I didn't trust nothing. I didn't have any capacity to trust nothing. I was closed to it. And I didn't have any way to open up or understand trusting because I kept kind of out of ignorance just following the patterns of whatever came in front of me, not paying attention to the view. But when you step out on the path, you step out with right view. The whole point of this month is to begin to check this, what assumptions are coming on here. If you see yourself spinning in some thought patterns, you could try to just get rid of them. And you might get rid of them. You might watch TV, listen to music, go call a friend, do something, and you get rid of it. And you're like, hey, I'm good now. You know, just about an hour, maybe two, depending on how long the movie is, it's going to start coming back, coming back, coming back, coming back. Because your view is that I will be happy if I just get rid of those thoughts. But this month, we want to try to see what is the view that's going on behind those. What assumptions are triggering that constant flow of thinking, that constant obsession over this? But something then begins to happen when we start paying attention to this very moment. You start paying attention to this very moment and what I am doing in this very moment. Because you begin to pay attention. I remember the first times I begin to see the discomfort in other people's faces about my behavior. It was a shock because I never paid attention to other people's. I'm not like I was trying to be mean to people, but I just never paid attention to what other people thought about my opinion about something. I just was in my opinion. And my way was right. And so I didn't really pay attention to what other people thought. I thought they'd be happy once they squared up and started doing what I said. We won't have any problems. So we don't see that we're actually creating all this consequences to our behavior that's going to eventually come back to us. But when you start kind of getting this opening understanding, which is why I like that comma, does not matter whether you do something good or bad. It's beginning to see the consequential connection between what I do right now. And if you could see that, then you would begin to pay attention to what you're doing. You wouldn't let your mind just wander off on these crazy thoughts and just beat on you and beat on you and beat on you without somehow or another saying, whoa, 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 because I'm setting in motion the continuation of all of this. You start paying attention to it, you start beginning to see from a different perspective. Ajahn Chah, another quote I have from Ajahn Chah, he said, the Dhamma has to sink deeply into the mind so that whatever we do, the mind has always goodness within it. All the ways of making merit are aiming at this. Goodness lies in the right view that is established in the mind. Then we don't have to celebrate it or let anybody know about it. Simply let the mind have firm confidence in the goodness and keep going like this. That's it. We're trying to see if we can begin to pay attention to right now. So if you think about it, good or bad right now, it doesn't matter. There's no, oh, I see all this bad stuff I've been doing. Okay, just see that. Look at that. That's okay. Look at the good stuff I've been doing. See that. Because what you're looking for is what's behind it. If what is behind it is trapped in the roots of greed, hatred, and delusion, you're on your way to suffering. It's coming. It might lay dormant, but it's coming. If what your actions are based in these vows we make of non-harm, goodwill, and restraint of the senses, then you're on your way. You don't know when it's going to happen. You don't know what goodness, where. It's just going to come whenever it ripens. But it's like Ajahn Chah is saying, you begin to deeply let the Dhamma affect the mind so that goodness, non-harm, restraint becomes this natural impulse. And if I hear myself ever talking to myself, even remotely, like I used to, yeah, that's stopping right then and there. If I hear it, just a little sliver sometimes because I laugh because I come from trauma. So the mind, this mind, I call it like a trauma mind. So every time something new comes up, its go-to energy is some trauma. But there was a time I would let my mind just go on and on and on. It just doesn't happen like that anymore. So it comes from this vigilance about paying attention to where the mind is going, what deeds we're doing, regardless of those deeds. Then something else happens. Something kicks in. And that's this super mundane right view, superior mundane. I like the way this is, superior mundane, super mundane. Because mundane seems kind of boring, casual, who cares? That's the old common stuff. That's not the good china that mama would bring out. It's the old stuff that she had in the kitchen. You know, it doesn't all match. It's just the junk stuff we use every day. But this is super everyday stuff. Superior. It's at this point, I think, somebody asked a question last month about, is it the view? Is it your conduct? Which one comes first? So in the path direction, view is what you begin to cultivate first. You begin to cultivate this understanding of the view being that everything I do has got some consequences here, so I need to pay attention to those consequences. But then, when this view begins to affect conduct, it begins to have this effect on it, and that's the super mundane right view. That's what kicks in. I like the way Bhikkhu Bodhi explains it, so I'm going to read this little quote, what he says. He says, wisdom, which includes right view and right intention, that we're going to talk about next month, is the last stage of the threefold training. Well, let me just back up one little second. He says, perplexity sometimes arises over an apparent inconsistency in the arrangement of the path factors and the threefold training. So remember, we talked about wisdom being the first two, view and intention. The middle is ethical discipline. It's your conduct, your speech, and your livelihood. And then the last section is your mental stability, which is your effort, your mindfulness, and your concentration. So that's what he means by the threefold training. And it goes in that order, supposedly. So wisdom, which includes right view and right intention, is the last stage of the threefold training, meaning that this is what you get at the end of doing all your training. Yet its factors are placed at the beginning of the path rather than at the end. As might be expected, according to the canon of strict consistency. So what it means is, if you're going to follow the order, then right view, right intention should come at the end, after you've gotten your conduct all squared up. He says, but the sequence of the path factors, however, is not the result of a careless slip, but is determined by an important logical consideration, namely that right view and right intention of a preliminary type, which is this mundane, are called for at the onset to spur, as the spur for entering the threefold training. Right view provides the perspective for practice, right intention the sense of direction, but the two do not expire in this preparatory role. For when the mind has become refined by the training in moral discipline and concentration, it arrives at a superior right view, a right intention, which now forms the proper training in the higher wisdom. So what he's basically saying is that we start out by paying attention to our view in this mundane view of understanding karma. So we understand that whatever we do is going to have some consequences. So we start paying attention to what we're doing. That paying attention to what we're doing is going to move us into the moral, ethical discipline that we're going to talk about in a few months. Or I think Tim is pretty much talking about that. And that leads to a wanting, almost like a desire, for this much more steadier mental capacity to be able to stay with this conduct, stay with our behavior, and see and get at the root of it. When all of this begins to happen, what's really going on for us is we're beginning to really want to know and understand the Four Noble Truths. We're really beginning to have this desire beyond just, I want to fix my life. You stop caring about whether you fix your life, and you're more interested in what is the root cause of all this? What is actually going on in the way these habits keep showing up, in the way I keep doing certain things, in the way that I act, why did I act that way? And you're beginning to want to see on a much more deeper level this the Four Noble Truths, meaning that you're beginning to want to see suffering, not run from it, not fix it, but I want to see it. And not only do I want to see it, but I want to understand where its origin is. It's not about me anymore. I just want to understand. Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote this really great book about this. And he said that what actually happens, I wish I had brought it with me. Maybe I'll bring it to next week. But what he said is what happens is you begin to start this contemplating on the Four Noble Truths, reading it, studying it. Like there's a part of you, many of you I know have already hit that, like, I want to understand this Four Noble Truths. What is it that these people are talking about? You want to read it for yourself and get more into it. Read it from different people. Look it up online. Whatever we do, we begin to read it, study it, contemplate about it. And then your meditation becomes the fertile ground in which you want to practice it. So when you're in your meditation practice and something comes up, you're not going to just immediately try to get rid of that difficulty. You're going to want to turn and investigate, what is the nature of that difficulty? Where did this come from? Why is this here? What is this that's going on? What is it exactly? Why do I even think it's difficult? You want to begin to investigate it. And that mental stability that comes in the third part of the training, in the concentration part of the threefold training, that mental stability begins to get stronger and you stay with it and you see it. But then ultimately, when you begin to stay with it, see it, then you start having this capacity to see into this superior mundane way. You begin to see where the path itself comes into play, how it works. And the whole path begins to be the vehicle that helps you see the other three even stronger. So His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama, he wrote that whether our actions are wholesome or unwholesome depends on whether the action or deed arises from a disciplined or an undisciplined state of mind. So whether our actions are wholesome or unwholesome depends on whether the action or deed arises from a disciplined or undisciplined state of mind. It is felt that a disciplined mind leads to happiness, and an undisciplined mind leads to suffering. That's what I think. But in fact, it is said that bringing about discipline within one's mind is the essence of the Buddha's teachings. So this isn't about whether or not your anxiety during a sit, during your life, comes or goes. Because that coming or going, good sit, good deed, bad deed, all of that's just all conditioned. And you may or may not can affect those conditions in any given moment, but it does not change the conditioning nature of everything. Where our sort of, where the practice is leading us for liberation is to begin to bring discipline into the mind. So when you're sitting there with whatever is arising and you are willing to practice what it takes to bring the discipline to be able to see it, watch it, investigate it, stay with it, then you're on this road of Buddha's path. Then you're on the path. You're not trying to fix life, make life better. You're not worried so much about that as you are worried about, do I know what's going on here? Do I have the discipline to stay with it and watch it and investigate it and see into it? And that is a much more super mundane view. That view comes from starting out with your view to pay attention to this moment, beginning to notice your conduct in such a way that you start saying, oh, I'm gonna have to look at this a little bit more, check this out a little bit more, developing our capacity to stay with it in meditation. And then we begin to see that the true path has less to do with whether things go good or bad, but whether we have the capacity to stay with whatever that is and investigate it. I think probably the best thing I've ever learned out of all the views, this I don't know if I told you guys this, but if I did, I'm sorry, I'm gonna tell you again. But this thing that this student of mine shared with me, it's so moving to me. I have to share it with everybody. Because I had a student that was racked with all this anxiety all the time. And we tried to talk about meditation, but it was like, he's like, I just want to study. I just want to study the Dhamma. I'm like, but you're going to have to be still with the difficulty here. He's like, So I asked him to just tell me, you have to describe everything to me. He didn't know. I'm doing backdoor meditation, but that's okay. I'm like, you have to describe everything. You can't just come and just give me some storyline about something. You got to tell me what you felt, what you saw, how you saw it, what you thought, what you heard. And so he would come and he would be like, yeah, okay, I saw this, I saw that. And I'm like, okay, that's good. You just keep looking and tell me again. So every time we'd get together, he would give me this litany. He goes, I don't just even know what this is doing, but okay, he saw this. But as he began to tell me, I could hear that he was noticing a lot. He was seeing into things. He was noticing how his habits would show up, and this would happen, that would happen, this would happen, that would happen. I'm hearing all this. So one day, he had some problem with his medication. He was changing medication, and he had this major panic attack. So our appointment was usually on a Thursday, and he had this major panic attack probably 3 or 4 days before. Just this panic, just anxiety, and was horrid, he said. So when I saw him, he's like, oh my God, it's terrible. It was awful. And I said, oh, what did you do? Did you like drink it away? No. I said, well, did you yell at people? These are his habits, right? Yelling at everybody because he has anxiety. He's like, no. Did you just get weighty with your partner? No, I didn't do anything like that. I'm like, well, what did you do? He goes, I just kept thinking, you got to watch this because you got to explain it to Ari. It's gonna needs to be important. I got to say it. It's, something's important. Just watch what's going on. And I said, well, okay, what do you have to report? He goes, it goes away. That's it. It goes away. He goes, I just realized that even though the anxiety would come and it would get all big, and then it would go away. And that is the Dhamma. Whatever arises, whatever is subject to arising, is subject to ceasing. And that wisdom we want to see. Not because we did something to fix the conditions and make it better, but because we know that whatever is subject to arising, whatever is conditional, is subject to ceasing. And we just gotta practice so we can see that for ourselves. Because once he saw it, that was it. We don't have no conversations about anxiety. We don't have that, oh, no, don't say meditation. Now he sits on his own. Not because he's so much better, but because he's not afraid of that anxiety. Just comes and goes. So, I'll leave it there. Thank you for your kind attention. We'll sit a moment. Read my poem again. When the radio in my car broke, I started to notice the trees. I began to stop exaggerating the color of leaves, how the red and orange need no wordy embellishment. I started to open my window and smell the wet pavement after morning rain. The crows on the phone line, their blackness and stubborn dignity. I even noticed my hands gripping the steering wheel, the small dark hairs, the skin, and the knuckles, and the perfect blue veins. So I'll see if there's any questions for us. See if I can answer them. Yes. So the comments that in past talks, he's always heard right view described as being around interconnectedness of all things. And yes, that's what my, it's all interconnected. And so it's all part of our actions, our thoughts, our deeds, and everything. And not just interconnected because of the spreading out of our behavior or conduct or, you know, our actions, but it's interconnected because it's all conditional. So we're bumping up into each other, we're bumping up into our lives, we're bumping up against our past, we're bumping up against expectations we have in our future, we're bumping up against all of this stuff. And all of this is all being kind of orchestrated by the mental factor of this view that we're holding. So that view, if it's wrong, oh man, you can see we're just gonna be going off on who knows what tangent. And so the beginning to see how integral your view is how you begin to see how interconnected things are, because you begin to see your view affects everything in your world. Much more so than, you know, some of the politics that we have going on. We're being more affected by our view than we are by the actual politics of going on. It's beginning to see that. In fact, Bhikkhu Bodhi, just to go a little bit further, Bhikkhu Bodhi said that one of the hardest things for practitioners, lay practitioners, in practicing with Buddha's understanding is that we think of this idea that there are these societal rights and wrongs, right? There's a right and a wrong. And we have these big, huge societal beliefs that are affected by society, and we follow into those societal beliefs, thinking that this is the way we should be. It's how discrimination happens. It's how giant swaths of people go through hell, because all of society believes one way and we all kind of just follow into those beliefs and we don't pay any attention to the consequences of those beliefs. And in the long run, it's wrong view. It's if it's not held in the view of doing no harm, this greater goodwill and kindness to all beings, and this coming from this place of restraint of the sense doors, it's wrong view. It's based in greed, hatred, or delusion. And so even though we're all following into these pathways thinking, oh, this is the way we should be, it's not necessarily the right view. But if you think about it, this is what I thought when I read that. Think of all, okay, so I'm in a room primarily white people. So think of all the white people who did not agree with the Klan or the Jim Crow laws or all these huge discriminatory laws that we had in this country. Just flat out didn't agree with it. Don't agree with that at all. But just think, those rules were in place for years. In fact, I think the white people were as scared of the Klan as we were. So it's sort of like this kind of way you can begin to see how societal we are stuck in these gigantic views. And we don't see how much those views are pushing up against us. So I laugh, but a lot of my friends laugh at me because I walk across the street whether the light is green or not. If there's no cars, I'm going across the street. But I have all these friends that are like, but. And one time I actually asked Rodney, like, I feel so bad because I keep walking across the street when jaywalking. And Rodney looks at me and he goes, and your point is? I'm like, I'm trying to see, am I doing something wrong? And he just looks at me, he's like, Tori, are you causing harm? I'm like, no. Don't ask me questions like that. It's pitiful. You know, it's getting a little bit too much. But still, if everybody, someone told me, if everybody just kind of walked whenever they want to, like me, then we wouldn't really have any kind of structure, right? So it's not that you're trying to just completely throw structure to the wind, but you're trying to check to make sure that that behavior, that structure you're following, you're not just following it without paying attention to the overall consequences of these kind of societal rules that we just, norms, we follow them. But, because we're not rocking the boat and we don't want to create any like mishaps. But at the same time, we're not paying attention to the consequences of that behavior. It's just, it's undisciplined, unmindful, and it's stuck in wrong view. And then we get some of the situations we're in right now, just stuck in it. We got to kind of live with it and work with it. But that's sort of what you're trying to see. You're not trying to decide, is it good or bad? Or everybody can say, oh yeah, Jim Crow was bad. Or, you know, I believe that, you know, the Klan is bad. It's easy to say that. But that's not really what the view is pointing at. It's pointing more how you are actually living in the world and paying attention to what views are behind it. So that means people nowadays are going to have to start looking at some of this white fragility, white privilege. It's all awkward, hard to look at it. It is hard to look at it. Because somehow or another we are afraid that it means, oh, I got to look at me. I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm trying to be nice. That's like me thinking, oh, I'm being nice. I just think my way is right. I'm trying to be kind to people. I'm not trying to be mean and hurtful. But when you start looking at people's faces, yeah, you realize you are being hurtful. Whether you're trying to be or not is really irrelevant. They don't really care whether I'm trying to be nice. I hate to just get lost in talking, but I had a secretary one time. She was my legal secretary. This is what it does to you. So I'm a Virgo. So, you know, that means I'm a little picky about things. Got to be just like this. So she would type up my motions. And she says she would wait. Because she knows as soon as she sends it, I'm going to open that door. Sure enough, I'd open the door to come correct it. And one day I came out of my office and I looked at her. And she just was like, oh, I saw that. I was like, is it that bad? Be what? What? That's when she told me. She goes, Tori, I have to fix the periods, the commas. I have to fix. You are so persnickety that it is like 12, 13 times I got to retype something. I didn't know that. I was trying to help it look better. You know, I just had a thing, right? You don't know that. Somebody has to tell you. Somebody has to call you on your behavior. So every time somebody calls you on something or everybody says, gives you that look like, ugh, there she goes again, do not think, oh, they're being so rude to me. You better think, okay, what exactly am I doing here? It's beginning to see that. It's painful, but we came up with a deal. I came up with a structure, how I wanted it to look. I gave it to her, she typed it up that way, and any other changes I wanted to make, I was gonna have to do it myself. Funny how that worked. I didn't make so many changes after that. It was always right. But you're trying to see that. Somebody else has to reflect back to you who you are, because you won't necessarily see it yourself. Let's see if somebody else has something. Yeah.
So I'm thinking about what you said earlier about the conditions, rise and fall. And if I can see how my view is affected by those things that I really, in many ways, didn't have any control over, where I was born, and people influenced me, mm-hmm. the experience. Mm-hmm. And so then someone says, this, or, you know, oh, it's not maybe, it's just these conditions that came in.
Right. Yeah, so the comment is that when you think about the rising and falling of conditions, then you begin to see quite clearly that a lot of the conditioning that we're faced with, we didn't have any control over it, right? We were born a certain place, we got certain parents, certain things happen. So then when you can see how much the conditionings has very little to do with you, then when you're seeing the conditions, this is where I'm a little unclear. So when you're saying you're seeing the conditions and someone is responding back, you take it less personal. Yes. Yes. That taking it personal. So both coins, it's like a quarter. It might be a heads or it might be tails, but it's still a quarter. Same kind of thing. When you feel the tightening of the self taking it personal, that's closed, like Pema Chodron says. That's closed. That's your opportunity to open. When you feel that you're not taking it personal and you're noticing that you're opening, that's beginning to have wisdom. And you begin to see, oh, I see I'm open here. I see I'm not so rigid in thinking my way is the right way. I'm open to other ways, other things. So when you're closed, you're closed, you notice that. When you're open, you notice that. It's not you either way. It's just beginning to notice this opening, closing that we get when we get caught in conditions. But it does one step further also. It helps us see the conditions other people are living out of. So that we're not only seeing our own conditions, we can open to other people's conditions. Then you can see what other people are living out of. And when you can see what other people are living out of, then you can begin to open to their suffering, their difficulties, their sadness. You can open to it. You're not just like, I don't want to hear about any of this because it's too difficult and there's nothing I can do about it. You could actually open to the sadness, the compassion of it, even if you can't do anything about it. It's more like that. That's view. All right. So we're going to work on this all month. Next week, we're actually going to talk about the social implications of this, which is kind of scary. But I always like to talk about the implications of whatever we talk about. And when it comes to view and our effects on the world, social implications are big deals. So next week we're going to talk about some of the social implications of this view and what it does to us in the long run. And then it'll be, you know, like a summary of this and then the implications around societal things and a discussion on it. Okay? Good?